A shooting attack in the Akbar al-Quds injures Israeli settlers amid tensions following the recent Israeli aggression in the Gaza and West Bank. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance groups hail the Operation Al-Quds as a natural response to Israeli crimes and part of the struggle against the occupiers. Plus, North Korea is slamming the UN chief's comments about the denuclearization of Pyongyang, saying that his words lack impartiality and fairness. It's good to have you with us. Now, beginning with the Akbar al-Quds, where there's been a shooting incident, at least 9 people are said to have sustained injuries. 3 of them are in critical condition. The pre-dawn incident happened when a gunman opened fire on a bus in the old city of al-Quds. Israeli officials branding it a terrorist attack. Gaza-based Palestinian resistance movements have hailed it as courageous. Hamas calls it a natural response to Israeli crimes against Palestinians and holy Muslim sites. The Islamic Jihad said this is part of resistance against the occupiers. Last week, a 3-day Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip killed some 50 people. Israeli forces also recently stepped up raids in the West Bank, killing nearly 60 Palestinians since late March. In the same period, attacks on Israeli targets killed 19 people. From Ramallah, our correspondent Mona Kandil has the latest about the shooting attack.
Well, as you have mentioned, at least 9 Israeli settlers were wounded during this anti-Israel operation and shooting that was carried out early Sunday or after midnight Saturday in Al-Quds in 3 different parts of the old town of Al-Quds. A Palestinian opened fire using his gun at an Israeli bus, then an Israeli vehicle in Al-Quds. The Israeli soldiers raided Silwan neighborhood in Al-Quds and other neighborhoods in Al-Quds. They arrested a number of Palestinians, and later the Israeli military said that 28-year-old Palestinian Amir Saidawi from Al-Quds has turned himself to the Israeli soldiers or to the Israeli police after the Israeli troops arrested family members from Al-Quds. He turned himself in, and as well as his arm. According to the Israelis, this Palestinian young man is being interrogated, but according to some Israeli media, they are not 100% sure that he was the perpetrator. However, the interrogation is still going on.
In the Gaza Strip, our correspondent Ashraf Shannon tells us how the news of the Al-Quds attack was received in the blockaded Palestinian territory.
Palestinian resistance groups have welcomed the shooting operation in occupied Al-Quds, describing it as a heroic operation. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhoum said that the operation Al-Quds is a natural response to the arrogance of the Israeli regime and the crimes of the settlers and the daily attacks against Palestinians. And he also said that the Palestinians are fully aware that only resistance, specifically armed resistance, is the best way to fight the occupation and liberate Palestinian lands. Another Hamas official in charge of the Al-Quds file, Mohammed Hamada, he said that this operation comes in response to the massacre that the Israeli regime carried out in Gaza over a week ago, and also to the assassination of a Palestinian resistance fighter in Nablus.
The public analyst Barak Grossman believes that Palestinians have every right to act in self-defense when they are being constantly attacked by Israeli troops. Let's take a listen.
You don't have to be an international lawyer. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that if your neighbors, your family members, your people are constantly targeted by men in uniform with automatic weapons who shoot them dead, very often using snipers from a distance, shooting at children who are doing nothing that qualifies as a threat, it's only natural that there will come a breaking point at which people will respond against those who are tormenting them, and we're certainly well past that point, and we're now starting to see acts of armed resistance as matters escalate here in occupied Palestine, and of course it's only going to get worse. And it's not surprising that what we hear from the opposition is characterization of anything that Palestinians do as terrorism, while they continue to justify their murderous acts, their crimes against humanity committed by their own men in uniform under instructions from the highest level of the occupation government.
Iran's foreign minister says that the language of threat used by the U.S. won't work against his country and its people. Hossein Amjadollahian urges the White House to stop playing a blame game against Iran. He says this won't bring the U.S. impunity from the numerous terrorist crimes it's committed against thousands of people in Iran and elsewhere. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned Iran of severe consequences if it attacks Americans, including former government officials. A day earlier, the U.S. Justice Department announced criminal charges against an Iranian national for allegedly recruiting an assassin to kill former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Iran calls the allegations political. It denies any involvement in any such plot. North Korea criticizing the U.N. chief, calling for the complete and verifiable denuclearization. The North has dismissed comments by Antonio Guterres as dangerous, accusing him of backing the hostile policy of the United States. According to Pyongyang, the UN chief's comments lack impartiality and fairness. It says an irreversible denuclearization of North Korea would be a breach of its sovereignty. Guterres, who was in South Korea on a two-day visit, expressed commitment to denuclearization of the North. He called it a fundamental objective to bring peace, security, and stability to the entire region. Washington and Seoul have for a while raised concerns about Pyongyang preparing to perform what would be its seventh nuclear test. In the meantime, thousands of South Korean progressives and unionists have gathered in downtown Seoul to protest the joint U.S.-South Korea military drills scheduled on August 22nd. Labor leaders call for an end to such drills, warning that the Korean Peninsula is inching toward a nuclear war. Frank Smith reports.
Thousands of South Korean unionists and their progressive supporters rallied in downtown Seoul to protest against joint U.S.-South Korea war games planned for later this month. The drills will be the largest in years and follow the May election of President Yoon Suk-yeol, who's promised to take a hard line with North Korea. Union leaders worry about risks.
The threat of nuclear war is growing on the Korean Peninsula. Conservative forces of Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea and those in the U.S. are frantically conducting aggressive war drills in the sky, the land and the sea, and are about to start large-scale joint military exercises aimed at the invasion of North Korea. We must stamp out this behavior of anti-reunification forces.
While many South Koreans, especially supporters of President Yoon on the right, favor close ties with the U.S., large numbers also argue the U.S. military and the country's alliance with Washington prevent the improvement of ties with North Korea and generate tension.
We not only oppose the war exercises, but we want the U.S. forces, Korea, which is actually controlling and interfering with the Korean Peninsula, to leave this land. We believe that only then will the 80 million Koreans from both North and South be able to live peacefully.
The drills will reportedly involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group with extensive field training to include amphibious maneuvers. South Korea has also been training alongside U.S. forces with recently acquired American F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. In an effort to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance, military officials from Seoul and Washington will meet to discuss the deployment of U.S. strategic assets and extended deterrence, which refers to the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons in the defense of South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Now, in other news, Salman Rushdie, the author of a highly controversial anti-Islam book, has reportedly been taken off the ventilator, is now able to talk, and that a day after he was seriously wounded in an attack. Rushdie was stabbed on stage during an event in New York on Friday. 24-year-old suspect Hadi Matar has pleaded not guilty to charges of attempted murder and assault. A lawyer entered a plea on his behalf during a formal hearing at a court in New York. U.S. prosecutors are remanding Matar, who is from New Jersey, in custody without bail. Rushdie published his sacrilegious novel, The Satanic Verses, in the late 80s. The book triggered an outcry across the Muslim world. The political commentator Mohsen Abbas says that Rushdie was a tool used in the hands of the West to confront Islam.
On an individual level, he'd kind of outlived his usefulness. I guess Rushdie takes the inauspicious honor or denigration of being, the first potential tool of Western neoliberal deep state in that process of its war on Islam, the real Islam, which talks about justice and talks about governments, which should be just, and talks about a system which is, you know, anti-usurious, perhaps, anti-corruption, anti-exploitation of the masses.
Studies into hate crimes in Austria have revealed that anti-Muslim hate is on the rise in that country. Perhaps most shockingly of all is that Islamophobic hate crimes appear to have increased sharply, and that following government initiative to uproot what it calls political Islam. Robert Carter is in Vienna to investigate further.
Austria is famous for its stunning architecture and artistic legacy, boasting to be the home of the great German composers, including Mozart and Beethoven. Sadly, however, Austria has built up another reputation in recent years, that of growing intolerance towards its Muslim minority. According to data released in June 2022, over 1,000 Islamophobic incidents were reported the previous year, a shocking increase which has grown year upon year. Research into anti-Muslim hate crimes in Austria have found that the overwhelming majority of the incidents which take place has been men targeting women, with a staggering 69% of victims being female, many of whom wear the hijab. However, it's not just on the street level where the targeted harassment of Muslims is taking place. The sharp spike of 2021 was allegedly assisted by the controversial state-implemented Islam map, introduced by authorities to highlight the location of all mosques across Austria. Critics believe it aided in the spread of hate crimes.
I don't think you can name a single visibly Muslim person in this country that hasn't been verbally attacked or even physically. And I try to not give a lot of attention to the individual attacks I face, because that would just be,
Although it was hard to relive the experience, Iman doesn't believe in playing the victim, instead focusing on the root cause.
Focusing on a single perpetrator and focusing my anger towards him would be very weakening, in my opinion, because in the end he has fallen victim to the narrative that the state has given him about us being a threat.
In November 2020, Austrian authorities launched Operation Luxor, which saw homes and offices of Muslim charities and activists raided as part of a so-called war on political Islam. But critics claim its only achievement is dehumanizing Muslims and fueling growing public fear towards Islam. An increase in fear almost certainly leads to more hate. Robert Carter, Vienna.
In an unprecedented incident, the FBI searched former President Trump's residence in Florida. A search warrant, unsealed by a judge, says the top-secret files were seized from his estate. Trump is accused of violating rules on official record, something that he denies. The former president and his Republican allies have accused the FBI of being corrupt and politicized.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI's Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Well, I think it's true that there are people in the permanent national security wing of the U.S. government who don't want Trump to return to office. And whether or not those people are currently raiding Trump in Mar-a-Lago in order to try to get proof of crimes they could use to charge him and put him in a position where he legally can't run for office.
And with that, we come to this broadcast from Tehran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The Leader's Viewpoint on Imam Hussein's Revolution and Ashura. Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam awakened the conscience of the people. So you see, after the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, Islamic uprisings were launched one after another. Of course, they were suppressed, but it is not important if a movement is suppressed by the enemy. It is surely bitter, but more bitter than that is when a society does not respond to the enemy. This is a great danger. With his uprising, Imam Hussein ibn Ali inspired individuals in all eras of the rule of tyrannies to fight against oppressive and corrupt establishments with a willpower stronger than those of the time of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam. Even though they lived farther from the early years of Islam, and they were all suppressed. From the case of the uprising of the people of Medina, known as Harra event, to the subsequent cases of Tawabin and Mukhtar uprisings, to the time of Umayyad and Bani Abbas, there were repeatedly uprisings within the nations. Who inspired these uprisings?
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If Imam Hussein had not risen up, would the spirit of laziness and irresponsibility change into the spirit of oppression, countering, and responsibility? Why do we say the spirit of responsibility had died? Because Imam Hussein went to Mecca from Medina, the center of the nobles of Islam, the son of Abbas, the son of Zubair, the son of Umar, the son of early caliphs of Islam, all gathered in Medina. And no one of them was willing to help Imam Hussein in that bloody and historic uprising. So, before the launching of Imam Hussein's uprising, even the elites were not ready to take a step. But after the uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, this spirit was aroused. This is a great lesson to be learned from the event of Ashura, along with other lessons. It is the lesson of Ashura which always live on as eternal and permanent debates not confined to a specific time. The lesson we learn from Ashura is the lesson of sacrifice and religiosity, the lesson of courage, justice, and the lesson of rising up for God's cause, and the lesson of love and compassion.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tensions are still high between China and Taiwan. The flare-up comes days after the provocative visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. Officials in Chinese Taipei have rejected the one-country, two-systems plan proposed by China for the self-ruled island. Taipei says that only the Taiwanese can decide the island's future. The reaction came after China published a white paper on Taiwan, which Beijing says shows the resolute determination of Beijing to peacefully resolve the unification issue. The paper lays out China's position on the self-ruled island. It says Beijing would never allow any attempt to separate Taiwan, but also would make every effort to achieve unification through peaceful means. Taiwan has accused Beijing of using House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit as, quote, an excuse to destroy the status quo. Pelosi visited the island on August 2nd, despite vehement protests from China.
What they want to do with Taiwan is fight, U.S. wants to fight China to the last Taiwanese. If not to the last Japanese, if not enough, then to the last Korean. Ultimately, the U.S. will not fight the wars, it will finance them, it will give weapons, it will antagonize us, it will antagonize both sides, and that's what they want to do. And it's actually a replica to the World War II.
Beijing reacted with an unprecedented burst of military around the island. The drills lasted for several days. Taiwan has also launched live fire drills in the wake of China's largest ever military exercises. The white paper issued by China this week was the third document of its kind over Taiwan. The previous editions were the Taiwan Question and Reunification of China, which was published in 1993, and the One China Principle and the Taiwan Question, which came out in 2000. China insists differences in the social systems in mainland and Taiwan are, quote, neither an obstacle to reunification nor a justification for secessionism. But Beijing says it will not rule out the military option to achieve such reunification.
What China wants to do with this white paper is just to find a way with Taiwan to get it back to its sense, because reunification will happen. The problem is that if it doesn't happen peacefully, it will happen by force. China doesn't want to do it by force, but it's being pushed on the corner by the US, because the US is actually slowly declaring Taiwan independent.
Speaker Pelosi's controversial visit has undermined the One China policy, which is recognized by nearly all countries of the international community, including the United States. Under the policy, the international community recognizes Taiwan as part of China, and the U.S. is committed to recognizing and having formal ties with China rather than the island of Taiwan. But Washington, contrary to its stated policy, continues to undermine China's sovereignty and courts the secessionist government in Taipei.
So what is the one country, two system? It was applied actually the first time is in Hong Kong. And so since the handover in 1997, they applied the one country, two system. The way it was done in Hong Kong was that Hong Kong could keep its a very high degree of autonomy. And actually they did it for Hong Kong. And it was a way, a showcase that they could show to Taiwan to say, well, in case you were to reunify with the mainland, this would be the system.
China has proposed the one country, two systems model to win Taiwan back. The policy allowed the Chinese government to successfully solve the question of Hong Kong through diplomatic negotiations with the British government. Hong Kong was under colonial British rule since the 19th century. China resumed to exercise its sovereignty over the island on July 1, 1997.
But what happened in Hong Kong was that you had the external forces. You had a massive amount of money being poured by NED, National Endowment for Democracy, and you had the usual suspect, the whole team of regime change working for the US, the MI6, and they did everything to destroy the one country two system in Hong Kong, and that ended up with the riots. And then in 2020, you had the national security law.
Under the model, offshore regions like Hong Kong remain under China's sovereignty but can retain their own economic and administrative systems. Now China insists the same model could be applied to Taiwan.
Iran is making giant leaps in its peaceful space program. Iran has just launched its Khayyam satellite into orbit. The satellite was sent into space from the Moscow-operated Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. Khayyam satellite was sent into orbit on Tuesday by Soyuz 2.1B rocket. Iran says it will also use imagery from Khayyam to monitor Iran's borders and improve the country's capabilities in management and planning in the fields of agriculture, natural resources, environment, mining, and natural disasters. After all, Iran is surrounded by US bases, and terrorists have preyed on Iran to enter its soil to conduct terrorist operations. Contrary to claims made by Western media outlets, Tehran insists the Khayyam satellite is fully controlled by Iranian experts and technicians based inside Iran from the very beginning of its launch. However, not everyone is happy about this satellite launch. The US expressed anger at Iran's partnership with Russia and accused Iran that the aim of the satellite is spying, something Iran has categorically rejected. The US has said they suspected that the satellite could be used by Moscow to spy on troop movements in Ukraine. Yet, Iran is resolute in its cooperation with Russia. It has said it will continue production of such satellites with Russia, adding that it's a great honor for Iranian technicians to work alongside Russian technicians who have more than six decades of experience in the field.
Yes, well, the US government, of course, is particularly concerned about this. It really, in many respects, it should have seen this coming. It should have seen cooperation between states that it has under attack coming. But the arrogance, I think, of the US in particular, of Washington in particular, blinds it to these sorts of developments. They could ignore the fact, for example, that small states like Syria, like Cuba, were able to cooperate together. But when large states like Iran and Russia cooperate together, there's the inevitability. There's going to be new developments which free those countries, those peoples, from the domination of the US.
The launch of Khayyam satellite has been hailed as, quote, an important milestone in Russian-Iranian bilateral cooperation that paves the way for implementing new joint projects. It has ushered what Iran has dubbed as its strategic aerospace cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Russia now says it's open to cooperation in the field of space exploration with all interested countries and partners, specifically Iran. The launch is also seen as a major achievement for Iran, despite Western sanctions.
Okay, so it's very important. The cooperation between Iran and Russia in satellite technology is very important because it shows a cooperation between large states with great capacity, which are both under economic blockade by Washington in particular. I would say Washington rather than the West, because really there are some mixed feelings in some parts of other Western countries. But certainly Washington is very jealous of any sort of independent achievement by Iran or Russia.
Iran says Western sanctions cannot stop its scientific progress. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said that the successful launch of this satellite is a great achievement for Iran. This comes as Iran has made significant achievements in the field of science and technology in recent years. Earlier this year, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Force launched its second homegrown satellite into a low Earth orbit nearly 2 years after the launch of its first military satellite. The IRGC successfully put Nur 2 or Light 2 into orbit on March the 8th. Iran has already mastered the technology to build remote sensing satellites with an image resolution of 5 to 10 meters and can inject up to 50 kilogram packages into an orbit of 500 kilometers. But Khayyam can hit a much more precise resolution of 1 meter. Iran aims to achieve the technology to put a 100-kilogram satellite into the 500-kilometer orbit by next year.
Ten years have passed since the start of war in Syria, but the country still seems to be in the midst of a conflict. So who's fighting who, and why does this seem like a war without end? For years, the Syrian war was the biggest news story, but now not so much. Cities and railways are being rebuilt, domestic flights have even started up again. Meanwhile, foreign forces have, on the other hand, ramped up their efforts to push their own agenda. The UNHCR even says the amount of investment to fuel the ongoing crisis compared to the money to alleviate the impact of the war on the Syrian people is very little. When the war started, Syrian government forces fought against US and foreign-backed terrorists. The US, its allies such as the UK and France, as well as Saudi Arabia and others, sided with the opposition and supported these terrorists. But Syria's legitimate government also had its own allies, namely Russia and Iran. Amid the ongoing chaos, terrorists took advantage of the crisis and soon became a common enemy to everyone. Now, over the course of the years of conflict, Daesh continues to operate in northern Syria with the help of the US to achieve its own goals at the cost of the Syrian people. The US has been accused of both hiring terrorists and training them to destabilize the country. This comes while a large portion of northeast Syria's crude oil resources have fallen onto the hands of the US. So does this confirm that the US is in one way or another fueling the conflict to continue its illegal occupation and abuse of Syrian resources?
The big question is what right does the US have to be in Syria at all? It has no right. And everyone wants the U.S. out. Probably even Eastern Europe, the EU probably would like the U.S. to be out. So the U.S. is working with the other Syrian rebels, army defectors, rebel.
The Pentagon has confirmed that the Russian military conducted its second known strike in 2 months near a U.S. base in Syria. Moscow says the airstrike was conducted against a group of U.S.-backed militants in Syria near Al-Tanf. According to some reports, the U.S. then warned the terrorists to move their positions. The U.S. has used these terrorists interchangeably between Iraq and Syria to do its dirty work. It has also transported these terrorists to Afghanistan, with some reports indicating they were transported to Ukraine. The Russian strikes come at a sensitive time due to the Ukraine conflict and tensions between Moscow and Washington. The Pentagon is trying to ensure tensions don't escalate with Russian forces, including in Syria, where the two sides have operated in proximity to each other for several years. Both Russia and Syria have time and again stated that the U.S. is training former Daesh members. Moscow has even specifically stated that Washington is trying to further destabilize the country. It also says that the Al-Tanf U.S. base is illegal and that it and the area around it have become a void where terrorists operate unhindered. Since the Al-Tanf base formation, however, the United States has claimed that it's a temporary facility used to train partner forces to fight Daesh. It has rejected the Russian claims, saying Washington remains committed to killing Daesh and denying it safe havens.
And Russia warned the U.S. over 2 months ago in June. It said, we're going to be bombing. So, you know, and they were actually telling the U.S., okay, we're going to bomb. So then the U.S. can phone up to the Mughawar al-Thawr, the commanders of the revolution, and say, you know, you're going to be bombed. So, I mean, I think that's stopped. I think the Russia's getting a bit more assertive now, and they're like the neo-fascists in Ukraine, and there the U.S. is supporting the same kind of rebel forces against Russia. So it's the same scenario transplanted into Syria.
The U.S. cut ties with Damascus over alleged rights violations by the Syrian government. But now, despite attempts by Syria, Russia, and Iran to rebuild the war-ravaged country, American troops continue their illegal occupation of parts of Syria, hindering any such attempts and further proving Washington's twisted logic. Japan commemorates the 77th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Survivors and relatives mark the blast anniversary with a minute of silence. The United States dropped the first atomic bomb, codenamed Little Boy, on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, destroying the city and killing 140,000 people, mostly civilians and including many children. A second bomb 3 days later on Nagasaki killed another 70,000 and made Japan surrender and ended World War II. The bombs also left tens of thousands more dead in the months and years that followed, many from radiation-related illnesses. Many who survived the attacks continued to require welfare and medical care. During the memorial, the Japanese Prime Minister said the government would continue to support the survivors and demanded all nations to work together to promote the total abolition of nuclear weapons. It's still a goal far from being realized, but one held as strongly in the two cities that have suffered the most from such weapons. Meanwhile, the U.S., despite being the only country to have used weapons of mass destruction during a war, seems to have learned no lesson from the horrific incident.
Their weapons should be eliminated from the entire earth. The United States, as a government, as a nation, has learned really no lessons. In fact, although there was a strong movement to eliminate nuclear weapons in the 1970s, resulting in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, in which the United States pledged to eliminate nuclear weapons, it did not do so, and in fact, over the last few years has committed, from the end of the Obama administration, to a $1 trillion nuclear weapons modernization program, which runs directly in the face of any commitment to eliminating nuclear weapons. And so it's really, the United States really has nothing to say about other countries having nuclear weapons until it gets its own act together.
In 1968, the world agreed on a new agreement, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Over 190 countries are currently signed up. Nuclear powers agreed to reduce their arsenals, in exchange others agreed not to have them at all. In the 70s, the deals between Russia and the US continued, more focused on long-range missiles, and though the rivalry between these two global powers intensified in 1991, there was a new START treaty aimed at decreasing the size of their arsenals and underpinning the West's justification for these weapons, which is an idea generally referred to as nuclear deterrence. But now Russia has intensified its rhetoric of using nuclear weapons in the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. The U.S. and the EU, on the other hand, continue to provoke Moscow despite the threats.
Well, there really was no reason for this conflict with Russia other than the way in which it has aided the highly financialized speculative economy of the United States and, by extension, Germany, France, Great Britain, and Israel, which have committed to a system in which now, because of this massive printing of money and the creation of false assets, only a war economy can save them from this catastrophe. So provoking a war with Russia, a thoughtless and dangerous move, does have the effect of increasing the value of the dollar in the short term.
As tensions rise between these two countries, which still have the largest nuclear arsenals, the world is now forced to look at history and the present to avoid an incident similar to the tragedy of Hiroshima. During the 77th anniversary of the world's first atomic bomb attack, the United Nations Secretary General, while calling for disarmament, said the world is playing with a loaded gun.
And today, the world is in danger of forgetting the lessons forged years, 77 years ago. Almost 13,000 nuclear weapons are being held. Stockpiles are being upgraded. And the common thread of potential nuclear annihilation runs through geopolitical crises the world over, from the Middle East to the Korean Peninsula to Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
A clear example of such threat would be Israel, which has persisted on possessing nuclear weapons. Iran has pushed for the establishment of a Middle East zone free of weapons of mass destruction, which the Islamic Republic initiated at the UN. But Israel won't comply. Tehran has even repeatedly warned that West Asia and the entire world is being threatened by nuclear weapons of the Israeli regime and urged international pressure on Tel Aviv to make it join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, in this episode, we are going to talk about the importance of patience in the light of some traditions. Of course, patience is one of the most noble qualities that every individual should have and should try to have. There are people who are patient, there are people who are impatient. But what does the prophetic tradition or the traditions that we have received from the infallible imams say about being patient? According to a few traditions selected from a collection of traditions describing the importance of patience in Islam and other divine religions, of course, it may be summarized that patience has been recommended by all the divine prophets and righteous leaders to their successors and followers. As I said in one of the previous episodes, the Islamic sources, especially the Quran, is replete with verses, and the Islamic literature is replete with sayings from the infallible imams and from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, about the importance of patience, about the importance of exercising patience. And let us consider some narrations that have been recorded in our Islamic sources. The first narration that deals with the importance of exercising patience is a narration from Abu Hamza Somali, one of the famous and sincere followers of the Prophet of the Ahlul Bayt and a principal member of the Shia movement. He quotes from his leader and teacher Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam as saying, "When the last moments of his life arrived, my father Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam held me close to his chest and said, 'My son, I recommend to you what my father Imam Hussein recommended to me at the last moments of his life. My son, stand for truth even if it is bitter.'" So, brothers and sisters, from this tradition narrated from Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, we understand that we need to stand for truth, even if it is bitter, even if it is very painful. But in order for the truth to be established, in order for the society to be guided in the right path, it is necessary for every individual to be patient.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves.
is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
If we look at the example of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam and his family, they suffered a lot. Especially on the day of Ashura, we know for sure that Imam Hussein gave his life in order to revive the tree of Islam, in order to protect the religion of his grandfather. Not only Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam gave his life, but he also sacrificed the lives of his children, the lives of his companions. And that was all aimed at establishing the truth. He stood for the truth at the cost of his life. And that is the pinnacle of patience. That is the summit of patience. Now, there are traditions, many other traditions. Of course, as I said, the Islamic literature is full of narrations about patience. Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam is the vicegerent and successor of his father Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam. And of course, Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam is the inheritor of the heavy burden of trust. He is responsible for the continuation of the struggle and the movement of his father, exactly in the same manner that Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam, Zain al-Abidin, was responsible for the continuation of the movement left by his father Imam Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam, the martyr and the chief of martyr of Karbala. Each personality from the household of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi sallam was responsible for the continuation of the divine mission of his predecessor. And all of them collectively were upholders of the divine mission of the last Prophet of Allah, peace be upon him and his family. And all of them are created from a single source of energy, light. All of them are the seekers of one direction and one aim. He says, "My son, I recommend to you what my father recommended me at the last moment of his life." So we all know that how and where the last moments of the life of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam were spent. The history is very clear. He was in the midst of turmoil on the day of Ashura, the 10th of Muharram and the year 61 Hijrah. So pains, torture, tragedy, and suffering dominated the bloody state of affairs in the plain of Karbala. The story of Karbala is one of a story that is really heart-rending, that's really painful, that's really difficult to even listen and to hear about. In spite of the fact that he was completely encircled by his bloodthirsty enemies, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam took advantage of a short opportunity to go back to his camp before starting his final attack. After having a brief meeting with the members of his household, who in their own ways were carriers of his mission, he held a short but sufficient, effective, and very important discussion with his vicegerent and successor, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn Zain al-Abidin. So these kinds of discussions in simple language may be called farewell meetings, but it must be understood that a pious leader like Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam is far above sentimental passions. Whatever reports which remains regarding the other great pious leaders, imams for example, has reached us, certifies the same thing. They stood for their truth. They stood for the establishment of the truth, and they exercised patience, they exercised forbearance to establish the truth.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Brothers and sisters, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam knew at that sensitive moment that the heavy burden of the trust for which he had struggled for since the beginning of his leadership had also been endured by the founder of the revolution, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, the commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and Imam Hassan alayhi salatu wasalam. And we know how much the Holy Prophet of Islam suffered when the Prophet, peace be upon him, first of all started his mission He suffered all kinds of difficulties and hardships at the hand of the Quraysh leaders, and they tormented the Holy Prophet of Islam. They threatened him. They did whatever they could to make him avoid his propagation of Islam. But the Prophet, peace be upon him, had said to the Quraysh and his enemies that if God placed the sun in his right hand and the moon on the right and the left hand, he would not stop. He would not stop preaching his religion, the religion of Allah. And he would not give up preaching, inviting people to the right religion. So that was how the Prophet suffered at the hands of the Quraysh and his enemies. Of course, the stories are very long. And I just wanted to give the example of the Prophet, peace be upon him, who suffered and who exercised patience. There are different accounts about the Prophet and his sufferings. And that's all for this episode. Brothers and sisters, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.
Internet trolls.
Part 2.
The Internet. What began as an exclusive tool to connect militaries, governments, and then universities has now, more than 60 years later, transformed everything about how modern societies operate and communicate. Today, no one can escape the grasp of social media or evade the mind-boggling connectivity that nearly all humans worldwide now have access to. But few have been prepared for what has also emerged with all this human connectedness. A new and ominous strain of human behavior has been unleashed. Increasingly, people are hiding behind a cloak of anonymity, waiting to provoke, harass, and even threaten anyone they choose. They are called Internet trolls.
A troll is someone devoting large parts of their life to attacking other people on the internet, basically trying to make that other person's life miserable in some way.
They send things to my home. It terrifies me to think what they could do if they wanted to, knowing exactly where I live, knowing where my children go to school.
Trolls can be a minor annoyance or a life-crippling terror. But what happens if society tries to silence them? Who loses then?
Trolling is a free speech issue, and if you aren't free to hate someone, then you're not free.
I've been associated with all kinds of organized trolling groups. We're stretching the bounds of free speech. You either use it or you lose it. Feelings will be hurt.
Politicians and the courts are now grappling with who really is a dangerous troll.
I've been called troll by very powerful people that should know better. Homophobe, misogynist, racist, all this stuff is just lazy people not wanting to interact.
Artist Gregory Allen Elliott is at the center of a landmark trolling case that might land him behind bars and forever change what any of us anywhere can or cannot say online.
If Mr. Elliott is convicted of a criminal offense, watch out. Nobody will be safe. You better shut up. Because if you don't, he could be going to jail.